broadcasting from the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs, Colorado. It's time for Kick Set with USA Swimming, bringing you interviews with athletes, coaches, and experts from age group swimming to the national and Olympic teams.
Hello and welcome to Kick Set. Thank you for joining us today. I am your host, Dan McCarthy. We're just coming off the Richmond stop of the Tier Pro Swim Series event, and it was a great one. If you were there, I hope you enjoyed yourself. I want to thank the staff at Swim RVA. They were phenomenal. The volunteers were great, and the meet organizers that got everything up and running before we got there was just top-notch, first-class, whatever you want to call it, but we had a great time there. It was a packed house every single night, and they got to see some great swims. The usual suspects, Katie Ledecky swam well, Simone Manuel, Caleb Dressel, Michael Andrew, all won events and sometimes did it in meet record fashion. It was fun to watch, but we got some big swims out of people that maybe were a little bit of a surprise, probably not to them and their coaches, but don't sleep on the times that Leah Smith and Olivia Smoliga and Annie Laser posted in their respective events. Some of those swims were the fastest times of the year so far, which is becoming a crowded list of results as teams have their trials. Different countries have their trials in preparation for World Championships and WUGs and the Pan American Games. We have two more stops left on the Tier Pro Swim Series circuit, Bloomington in May and Clovis, California this June. If you can get to one of these events, you should. It's a great time. It's fun. The final sessions are super enjoyable, and everybody has a great time. Lots of stuff going on for the kids, and I highly recommend you go to one of these stops if you haven't already been there. But if you can't get to one, make sure you check the website for streaming information and options, and also the NBC family of channels for broadcast information. We broadcast 2 out of 3 nights live on one of the NBC channels, and it's a first class broadcast. Rowdy's there. They bring in the NBC talent, and it's really worth tuning in if you have the chance. Okay, today I really hope you enjoy today's guest, Chris Webb. I've known Chris for at least 20 years, probably more like 25, and we may have worked together at some point in time in the past. Chris is extremely passionate about learning and has become really well-versed in a lot of topics: swim training, strength conditioning, childhood development, coach health and wellness. And we're going to take some time in this podcast to touch on those topics and a few others as well. You'll notice it's a little longer than some of the other podcasts that we have done in the past, but I think you're going to enjoy it. I didn't want to give a short shift to any of the topics and, you know, just trying to casually brush across them. So we took the time to dive into a couple things and have a good discussion about them. So Chris Webb, have a listen. How are you doing today, Chris?
Doing great. Thanks for having me, Dan.
No worries. So you're not on deck right now with a team officially. Is that correct?
That is correct. Not in an official capacity. I am not on a deck with any team. Correct.
All right. So what are you doing?
Well, I'm doing a handful of things. For those of you who know me, I tend to stick my fingers in a whole bunch of different cookie jars whenever I can. I'm currently probably doing most of my work in the strength and conditioning and athletic development world with a well-known gentleman by the name of Vern Gambetta. Gambetta Sports Training Systems, or better known to the swimming community as the GAIN Swimming Network, or the Gambetta Athletic Improvement Network. My relationship with Vern stems back well into the early 00s, where I first brought him in to work as a consultant in strength and conditioning at the Carmel Swim Club. So when I took my leave from coaching at T2 Aquatics in Naples, Florida, Vern was in Sarasota, which is just a little bit up the road. My passion has always been around different parts of the sport, and that's just one that has kind of stuck. And I've become kind of a go-to person for that type of stuff. So the relationship worked out really well between Vern and myself. I speak coach, quote unquote, and he speaks strength, quote unquote. So the marriage was very synergistic.
Okay. Do you consider Vern a mentor?
I consider Vern to be one of my primary mentors for sure. Yeah.
All right. This is an interesting topic and something that I guess we're looking at least within the national team division at USA Swimming, the mentorship network that currently exists, the coaching tree, quote unquote, on tree. And I think you have a very large stable of people that you would consider to be mentors, and not just mentors in the traditional sense of somebody that helped you along the way, but some higher profile mentors, if we're being honest, at least in the swimming world. Who would you call a mentor, say, over the last 20, 25 years of your career?
Oh, man. I'm easily sucked in by people who have great ideas and charismatic people. So, I mean, I have a lot of people. I forgive anybody if I forget them. But I would say probably going back into my earliest years, I would say, you for sure, Dan McCarthy, probably my earliest, my earliest mentor and person who said, "Hey, come with me. I'll show you the way." Maybe I don't know the way that well, but we'll work it through science and inquiry, and we're going to investigate things on how to do things the right way. If not the right way, then, you know, a better way than we did yesterday.
Somewhere.
So I would say, yeah, I would say that, you were my earliest force from a passion standpoint in wanting to be involved in kids' lives and wanting to, improve coaching in the sport of swimming, being in the area that we were in Western Pennsylvania. There wasn't a vacuum, but there was probably a lack of desire to punch out of the status quo. A lot of fantastic coaches, a lot of fantastic athletes in the Western Pennsylvania area, but there were definitely a much smaller group of people who were interested in saying, well, what's the next layer? Well, what's the next layer? Well, what's the next layer? Peeling away the layers of the onion, whether it be sports science or psychology. And I know that, exercise science being, your field of study in graduate school, obviously, I feel like my mentorship under you was very heavy in that field of study. But at the same time, I think, we'll probably talk a little bit more about this later, but I also feel it was also a really, really good reminder of, hey, these are the foundational values and foundational skills that make you a great coach. Because everybody has their fields of expertise, but I always felt like yourself, you were always telling me, hey, present yourself the way you want to be presented and come on time, come early, come prepared. Don't sit down, don't eat sandwiches in the middle of swim practice. A lot of the kind of things that are just timeless things that, not mentors, but just leaders should be doing.
Sure. Sure. Now, I think one of the important things in order to grow, whether you're talking about somebody that's, advances in the business world or, in banking or coaching,
sure,
is that they have an early mentorship. But in order for them to grow, they got to break away and start experiencing other things and learning from other people. So, moving forward from the days at the University of Pittsburgh, what mentors did you run into and learn from next?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, my thirst for knowledge or, my desire for scholarship, and I was actually just reading a history book and listening to, the genesis of the whole idea of scholarship. The desire to learn everything, I think that I was always excited to do that. And, you were always trying to pull the reins back on me because I wanted to be, I want to do this, I want to do that. And you're like, not yet. Slow down. Do deep diving into this thing. I'd say after I left the University of Pittsburgh, I went to Carmel Swim Club in Indiana. And I would say one of my biggest mentors there still is Chris Plum, who's the head coach of the Carmel Swim Club. He was a coworker and then my boss and a friend that has really guided me along, you know, the way, along with Tom Burchill, who brought me from Pittsburgh to Carmel Swim Club originally. And they were the people who really actually built much more on my foundational skills and value system of, you know, what are your coaching values? What do you value, and how are you going to move those? How are you going to move those things forward and advance those skills? Where are you weak? Where are you strong? And I would say, you know, Tom was preeminent in making me write down what I valued, so that I didn't just the one problem, if there is any problems in seeking knowledge, is that if you don't have a value system to lay them on top of, you can just blow in the wind wherever you know, your current fancy takes you. So you end up getting attracted to what I might call magnetic north rather than true north. So you can get pulled magnetically into a direction or into a philosophy or into you know, into a certain way of thinking, rather than always keeping your compass pointed towards true north. And the way to do that is to have a value system. So I think that Tom was preeminent in that. And then Chris, I think my time with Chris is, Chris taught me how to be a professional. You know, Chris sat me down and he was like, read the whole meat letter, read the whole thing, know where you're going, be a professional, tuck your shirt in, do this stuff, be prepared. Here's how a professional conducts business. Here's how you write itineraries. Here's how you do all these things. And Chris demanded a level of professionalism at the Carmel Swim Club that, you know, made us feel like we were important and that we were doing a great job at coaching. And obviously, you know, Chris allowed me to be who I was as a coach, which, as we all know, is more of a creative. So he was very good at recognizing my strengths and my weaknesses and allowing me to do that. And those were things that I was able to learn from Chris and take and put into my own leadership skills, which was know your strengths and use them, and know your weaknesses and find people who have those as strengths.
Okay. Backing up, you said something about, you know, knowing the difference between magnetic north and true north. And yeah. I think one of the things that happens a lot now in coaching, on both people that I don't want to say easily swayed, but you know, whatever the hot new thing is, that's kind of like a version of that. You maybe even a less rigorous version of it, because you know, you, most people would take the deep dive, but to just be influenced by something that you saw in a YouTube video or heard somebody talk about. But then also the, and I think this is where social media becomes an issue, where the backlash against the people that become interested in that creates a narrative and an argument that didn't really have to exist because something wasn't really that important in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a, you know, there's a lot of layers to that. You could have a whole podcast just on, on this subject matter alone. I mean, I have a couple of different varying opinions, and thoughts on this. My first one would be that, I gave a recent lecture at a clinic, and I do this thing where at the end of my lecture, I put up a slide of, you know, probably controversial subject matters that I have opinions on, but I'm not 100% sure where I lie. I'm looking for to stimulate thought and some other stuff. But one of the pieces of subject matter that I know is currently under heavy discussion is the whole idea of using USRPT, or ultra short race pace training. Some of the stuff that Dr. Ruschel has written extensively about in scientific literature. It also has been put into practice, you know, fairly famously, but not the full clinical approach exclusively, by Michael Andrew. And we all know how successful he's been. And, but also by Garrett McCaffrey at Phoenix Swim Club, who is a large proponent of that. And there's a lot of swim coaches who've come out, you know, promoting and espousing what they feel are the benefits of doing that type of training. Having said that, when that type of training came out, being who I am, the first thing I did was I tried to get a hold of Dr. Rushell. And then I read every piece of literature that he had. And then I bought the USRPT DVDs. And I watched all of those. And I took notes on them. And I read. And I tried to get a hold of anybody who was ever doing them. So I think one thing I did was the deep dive to me is essential. I felt that if I wanted to be able to take something and lay it on top of my current coaching value system, I needed to understand the intricacies of it and all the ins and outs and nooks and crannies, because I had already had great coaching and mentoring from Dan McCarthy, Chris Plum. I worked with Ian Murray, who's the current head coach of Dynamo. You know, I had had a lot of people in my and a lot of ideas. So for me to do anything new, I had to take the deepest dive possible. I think that's the only way you can do it and almost become someone who is, you know, a complete disciple or ideologue, you know, of that type of training or of those systems, so that you, when you back yourself out of that hole after jumping down the rabbit hole, you could say, okay, well, here's where this fits into my current system. Here's where this has, you know, no relevance to me, and I'll leave the rest and take the good stuff with me. So I think the deep dive has benefit. But at the same time, if you're not careful and you don't back yourself back out, you can end up having confirmation bias. You can end up, you know, what do they say when you're a ghost hunter? What happens when you search for ghosts? Well, eventually you find one. So sometimes you'll end up in a place where, you know, you're only seeing what you want to see. And that's probably the danger of some of those things, number one. And number two is, when I asked the question, when I asked that question about who liked the USRPT and for a bunch of swim coaches, I was staying in front of 110 coaches and one person raised their hand. And I said, who likes this? Well, so you guys don't like this. And they're all like, yes, we do not like this piece of training system. And then my follow-up question, Dan, it wasn't meant to be a trap, but it ended up being one. I said, how many of you have read the literature? Zero hands went up. How many of you have talked with Dr. Rushell? Zero hands went up. How many of you have talked with Mr. Andrew? Zero hands went up. So what I find is sometimes, you know, whether it's a certain dogma or a way that people just choose to approach certain things, is they get opinions from other people, or, you know, then they end up being, you know, just little sacred cows that people don't want to step over or slice away. That they make opinions on things without having proper amounts of either education or just exposure to an idea. So I don't know if that makes any sense, but that, you know, that's some of what I see in the sport now, is that people are making conclusions based on, frankly, no evidence and, you know, no real research or spending reasonable amount of time taking a look at what the pieces are. So I think that's, you know, something to think about.
Okay. This was one of my big fears about sitting down with you, Chris, was that that the clear path of questioning that I had was going to meander, which is absolutely fine, because I'm doing the same thing at this point. So if I wanted to make Twitter fodder out there for people, sure, to listen to this, is Chris Webb says there's really no wrong way to train. Yep. There might be something to learn from everything.
I mean, I guess inherently, if you were going to be absolutist, there probably is a wrong way to train. You know, drinking Gatorades and throwing up in the gutter is probably, you know, not to take pot shots, but I think we know that that's not the right way to train.
Right.
So there are definitely some absolutes, but as far as things within the, you know, in the realm of reasonability, I don't think there is one wrong way to do anything. I think that the most important thing you can do, like I said, is have a set of values, and then follow your set of values and whatever your training philosophy is going to be, and then constantly be testing that. And that's the most important thing you can do with the scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
You know, constantly be testing and trying your methodology and trying to disprove it. And that's what the end of seasons are for. And that's what having people coming in and working with you is for, and saying, hey, this doesn't work or this works. And actually speaking with your, having frank conversations with your athletes You know, even if they're younger, you know, having good conversations allows you to continually move the needle towards where you want to go. And I think that that's one thing. I don't care if it's LSD or, you know, meaning long, slow distance, if it's ultra short race-based training, you know, whatever it is, you know, we know that there are benefits. And frankly, you know, sports scientists won't like to hear this, but frankly, some of the things that they thought were true are not true. And we already know that we have a reproducibility problem with, you know, with 89 out of 100 of our most important studies in the medical world. So I can't believe that we have any less of a problem in exercise science of reproducibility. So my guess would be that, you know, we're back to seeing what we can see with our naked eye, with the coach's eye, and then, you know, testing and retesting constantly.
Along that line, I just finished a good book. It's called Good to Go by, I think her name is Christine. I forget her last name, but
she's the recovery book.
Yeah. She was a writer for 538 for Nate Silver's website. Mm-hmm. And essentially, you know, there's a lot of different things you can learn from all the different chapters, but the big takeaway I had from it is the most effective effect that we think we have in recovery right now is actually placebo. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's really, really hard to prove that anything from an ice bath to a certain way of eating or anything is fundamentally the only way to recover from training or competition. However, athletes that truly, truly, truly believe that some modality that they're using is what helps them be ready to go the next day or for the next session is the most powerful tool they can possess from a recovery standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't read all that book. I've read some excerpts. It's definitely on my reading list. It's on one of my big stacks. I would say that, you know, I'm not a professional in that realm, but I would say someone who's spent extensive time reading and you know, listening to Dr. William Sands, Dr. Randy Wilbur, and some other people who actually are experts in some of these things. I would say there's some clinical evidence that we know that recovery. So what do we know? Let's boil this all the way down. We know that recovery is essential. Stress, recover, supercompensate. We know that that's the path. We know that that's the way that it works. So since we know that, the question is, you know, what is recovery? Well, shoot, you know, we have everything from do nothing to sleep. You know, we have cut, you know, cryogenic chambers now and everything else that's going on. So you know, I think that as we study more and more sports science or just regular science, we know that it comes down to the individual. And I think that if what you're saying, whether it be psychosomatic, I mean, I'm not sure if that's what you're saying in the book. I believe that that's definitely important. You know, what do we know about the inflammation response now? We know even more about inflammation than we did just 10 years ago. We were still wrapping pitchers. 10 years ago, we were still wrapping pitchers' shoulders in ice immediately after pitching. Mm-hmm. And then we were figuring out, oh, this is actually retarding the inflammation response, which is the body's natural way of healing itself. So we're learning more and more day by day. Especially with recovery, that we don't really know what we're talking about. So let's just figure out some protocols that we know think works. And, you know, let's go with that. Let's go with what we're comfortable with and what the athlete seems to like. And, you know, take good data on that and see over time, you know, what goes. And I'd say that probably the biggest poison that we've experienced, in my humble opinion, in recovery in the last decade has been athlete monitoring and being able to tell your sports training staff in college, you know, what level of fatigue that you're actually in, and that being, you know, using that as a tool is to decide whether or not you should train, the abuse of that by athletes, and then actually, you know, your awareness of whether or not how tired you should be has become a problem, certainly for collegiate and professional athletes. Too much information, I guess, has become an issue.
Okay. Well, speaking of too much information, I'm definitely looking at the guardrails that I've set up here, and we've careened through them. Let me pull us back a little bit.
Sure.
So, I mean, and actually, so we're, you know, digging down into data-driven information, research, reading, sure. Learning, that sort of thing. back to the mentoring question, not all of your mentors, I mean, you talked about some of the soft skills that you learned, sure. You know, being a professional, how to prevent yourself, present sure. yourself. What about other skills such as psychology and relating to an athlete? Have you sure. had any mentors that have helped you with those skills?
Yeah, I mean, I would say one thing for sure is that if I have a skill, if I have a personal skill, I think that one of my skills as a coach is being able to relate to an athlete as a case study of one, and being able to do that on a daily basis has been really beneficial to me. I would say that I've had some mentors such as David Marsh, who are exceptional at cracking the tough nut, so to speak, like really getting in there and being able to work with athletes who've had issues along their path, and really finding a way to help them flourish. I would say that David's someone who's really helped me in that way. I would say that Vern has really helped me as well, kind of understanding the athlete, and I got to listen at his large summit every year at Rice, which is more than swim coaches. It's performance coaches from around the world. Listen to a guy just say the old adage of, it's not about the X's and the O's, it's about the Jimmies and the Joes. And the first time I heard someone say that, I said, this is just so true. Your number one thing is about getting your foot in the door and being able to build a relationship and build trust. And, time spent, that's a really important thing. I'd say that David has been one of my biggest mentors in that. And maybe even larger than David is probably Kathy McKee, who's one of the greatest swim coaches to walk the planet, for sure. Maybe people don't know who Kathy is, but Kathy's the age group coach, was the head age group coach when I was at Swim at Carolina. She was a dynamo before that. She's coached more Olympians than I can name. And is one of the most relationship-based coaches I've ever met.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. You've described, I don't have a head count here, but, at least five or six people that you consider mentors mm-hmm. enough to yep. mention them here. I don't know if that's a lot or not a lot, but it seems mm-hmm. like it seems like a healthy amount. And I know that you didn't have your first head coaching job until you were mid-30s?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Do you consider that a trade-off, or is that just the career path?
This could be another whole podcast thing. I mean, I think I try to talk to young coaches about some of this when I get the opportunity. I would say that my first brush with understanding this was when I was working for you down at the University of Pittsburgh, and I wanted to take a head coaching job at a very small local club, and your advice was, hey, why don't we wait? And I was so ready and raring to go to take over you don't know any better when you're young. So when you want to try to go do those things, you don't know what you don't know. And I learned a lot of those things along the way, apprenticing and paying my dues, so to speak. Although I look at it more as apprenticing than anything else, I want to feel like I was an apprentice to a master painter, and I learned how to grind the paint in a pestle, and I learned how to make it so that it went on to the canvas correctly. And then I learned how to hold a brush, and then I learned how to make a perfect brush stroke. And I wanted to believe that that was a real pathway in coaching. I wanted to believe that that was the way to do it. And one of the things I always go back to and I tell people is, and you probably don't even know you did this, but my first day of working for you as an age group coach, I wanted to jump in there and do all kinds of stuff. And you said, you're going to take attendance. And I was like, what? Why am I doing this? And you're like, you need to know everybody's name. And I thought that was stupid. But then I took all the attendance and I knew everybody's name. And then I'm like, okay, now I'm going to jump into this. And you said, here's a watch, take the splits. Know what people swim, understand the practice, read the practice, know why we're doing this. And every day you sat me down, even though I swam for you, Every day before practice, you said, this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. Look at these pieces of the workout. These are the places where you're going to have to be good. And the kids are going to have to swim really well. And I said, oh, man, this is – I really felt like it was almost, you know, the Karate Kid, where I was being told to sand the fence.
Right.
And I'm like, this is just crazy. What is this thing? And it took years and years. And maybe I think about it nostalgically like that now.
Sure.
But I understand that apprenticing style process where it's like stay focused on these individual things and learn the process, be a great apprentice, learn to dance the dance. And do these things well. And I kind of took that, you know, probably 50% as this is how you get great, and another 50% as, oh man, before I'm a head coach, I want to make sure that I know everything. And then I probably delayed some of my process. Honestly, was maybe a little bit of a lack of self-confidence and in thinking that I was good enough to be a head coach and worthy enough to be a head coach, because maybe the mentors that I had had and the people that I had worked with, they were so accomplished that I kind of wanted to hit the ground running and make no mistakes. That probably slowed my process down a little bit. But given the results that we had at Fort Collins, maybe it wasn't that bad that I took that long to take over a program.
Sure. Whenever it comes to youth sports, because, you know, that's largely what we deal with. Okay. Mm-hmm. We do, you know, working for the national team, of course, you know, the NCAA is extremely important, and our professional athletes are just as important and becoming more important every quad. Yeah. But as coaches, you know, we all have some sort of experience with the 18 and under athlete and
sure.
the whether it's based on schools or based on club, whatever. But that's where we're coming from. But in the world of youth sports, swimming is still pretty unusual. Whenever you look around, I know having kids now and going out into the youth sports world,
sure.
that almost all the sports are volunteer based. The coaching mm-hmm. is volunteer based. The administrators mm-hmm. are volunteer based, and it's not professional. Okay, mm-hmm. not to downgrade or talk ill about any of the other sports, but it's not professional. Mm-hmm. However, in USA Swimming, you know, granted that you can, you know, you possess the knowledge. You can pass the tests. You have the skills. You mm-hmm. can get a professional coaching job at a relatively young age.
Sure.
And that comes with some variables that when you're young aren't a big deal. You mm-hmm. know, if you're by yourself, you know, having practice every day at 5 o'clock is not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Traveling, you're not burdened to anybody else. So if you want to mm-hmm. go away for a 5-day trip, that's fine. Practice till 8-9 at night, why not?
Mm-hmm.
But at some point in time, your life changes and other people come into it, and maybe a whole family comes into it. And this creates a stress and problems that never existed before. And I think we probably always knew it was a problem, but I think, and actually you've, you know, opened a lot of people's eyes to us, is that it's a huge problem for coaches mm-hmm. in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you want to talk about some of those problems in a better way than I just tried to phrase it out there.
Or
if we want to just jump to solutions and ideas, I don't know. How would you like to handle this?
Well, I mean, I guess I'd like to talk about it maybe in a greater, maybe like an overarching, maybe on a macro level at first, and then we can dig down into some of the other things. But I would say that, you know, what this has become institutionally and like, from a hierarchical standpoint, is that like USA Swimming and the sport of swimming itself has over the time, you know, created this system that has shown to be successful at the highest levels, from Olympics to domestic swimming. There are certain practices, there are certain rules of thumb that you're rewarded for inside this hierarchy. Hard work and selflessness is a competent skill. It's an important thing to have in here, and it's rewarded. So there's a lot of different things that are rewarded with inside this system. But no matter what kind of system you have, you're always going to end up having people and things that become disenfranchised. Whether that's, we all know, within the swimming system, when we're, you know, reaching for the highest you know, for the highest levels, we're always going to have someone who falls short. And the same thing happens in the coaching. We're going to have people who reach the highest levels, and we're also going to have people who end up becoming failure is not the right word. They become tired and burned out and disenfranchised. No matter how successful the hierarchy is or the system of the institution is at creating, high level coaches, athletes, success at the highest level, we're always going to end up with a small amount of people who end up burned out, disenfranchised, or whatnot. Maybe I'm using the incorrect words for that, but I think the most important thing for us to always look at is the hierarchy, is the system, is the institution functioning? And is it functioning based on competence? And if that's the truth, then we have a good system. But we're always going to have a healthy tension between people and things that become disenfranchised in that hierarchy and institution. And how do we deal with that? And I think that's really maybe what you're talking about, is how do we deal with some of the collateral damage, so to speak, mm-hmm. with us trying to reach the highest levels, whether it just be for kids who are 8 and under swimmers or whether we're talking about Olympic podium swims. How do we deal with some of that? I spoke at the National Team Coaches Convention with Ian Murray about some of these things. It wasn't supposed to be a shock and awe campaign. We just wanted to open some eyes and get some people to understand that, hey, this institution and this hierarchy of USA Swimming / this profession, it does create amazing things. But at the same time, we do have some people who are ending up, burnt to a crisp at the end of this. We don't want to topple down this whole entire mountain. So how do we deal with it? And I think that, one of the things I like to talk about is three-stage acknowledgments, which is one, Dan, institutionally, what's the responsibility of an institution, whether it be USA Swimming, the NCAA, your swim club, your local LSC, or a college? What's your responsibility to long-term coaching success? And do you understand what that looks like? Or does it just look like Urban Meyer? You coach until you have a heart attack, then you come back. Then you coach until you're losing your family, then you come back. Do you need really epic things for you to stop in the coaching, in the coaching industry? Or does everybody along the pathway understand what long-term coaching success looks like? And if your institution has a good idea of that, and then you as an individual coach have a good idea of what that looks like for you, and then if the sport in general, I would say, the coaching profession in general also has an idea or an image of what long-term coaching success looks like, all three of those can work together to make sure that we have less and less collateral damage or disenfranchised coaches along the way without toppling our whole hierarchical institution and beautiful system that we have. Without saying, hey, let's tear the whole thing down because we have some coaches who didn't make it. How do we spread the responsibility and awareness so that we can do that? So that's to me, that's kind of where the whole thing needs to start.
Yeah, I agree. And I guess the awareness part of it has been the awareness, and even like the self-awareness of times has been the hardest part, because you and I have talked since last year, and I'd say we've probably done what, on review look to be some superficial things.
Yep.
To help coaches. Mm-hmm. But there's two problems there. The one is that you can't address a problem if you don't know or not willing to say that you have an issue or that you're sure. having problems. Mm-hmm. I know I laugh every time I think about it, whenever you and I were having a conversation about a coach that was giving advice about how a young coach should be managing their marriage and the relationship mm-hmm. with their spouse mm-hmm. So that they don't end up divorced like he is.
Yeah.
And the comedy in there is that, you feel as if you have enough information to advise this person, but obviously you failed for whatever it was, 10 or 12 years to see that sure. your marriage was failing. So
yeah.
that self-awareness, it sometimes is glaring. And the second one is the the fundamental awareness or the willingness to admit that small changes might be a big deal, you know, whether it be talking to someone or going to your board or starting an exercise program or, you know, deciding to eat more healthily, just like small little things could have a large impact. But having the awareness or an idea or a fundamental understanding of where to start is a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in this. A lot of these questions have been like that. I've been redundant in my response, but you know, I think of a couple of things. One, I'd just like to say this, you know, flat out. Some people are more competent than others. That's just a fact. Some people are going to be more competent at being able to manage, survive, and cope with the rigors of any industry or of any job. So there are going to be some people out there who are going to be highly successful and not highly successful, who are going to be able to take the stress. You're going to be able to take the long hours. They're going to be able to take the bad food and hospitality. They're going to be able to handle all those things. So that's the number one thing is that we're not all equal, but we do have to have a notion and an awareness of what our individual thresholds for these things are. And that will allow more of us to stay in the sport coaching successfully, happily, and coaching well for a longer period of time if we can recognize what our individual thresholds for certain things are. And first is recognizing your thresholds, and second is going to be being able to have a plan to deal with that, and having great mentors and being able to, you know, stand on the shoulders of giants and know what people have done before you is a really good way of, you know, not having to reinvent the wheel when you're trying to figure it out. Like, oh, what are those coaches doing in the morning run? Oh, Kurt Urbancheck and all these guys are going out for the morning run. Like, why would they do that? I thought you were supposed to stay out all late and stuff and do silly things at swim meets. No, you know, these people have come before you, man. They figured this out. Like, you don't have to do that. Know your thresholds and understand that everybody's going to be a little different. I do think we do have a little bit of a problem in our sport, unfortunately, which is in every industry, which is we deify the coach who you know, is a workaholic and maybe even has a little bit of a going out problem, you know, going out at night at meat problem and, you know, does these things and is the Iron Man, quote unquote, and, you know, shows no weakness. Because we put those people up on pedestals, sometimes we become less self-aware. And, you know, I always use this 4S system with athletes, and I'm starting to use it with coaches now, which is the 4S is, you know, top of a pyramid is self-confidence, self-awareness, self-reliance, and then self-acceptance. You know, if you're not confident in what you're doing and how you're doing it, everything's going to really, 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 really suffer. And self-awareness is really important. You have to, am I aware of what I'm doing to myself? Am I aware of what's going on? And then self-reliance, which is one of the pieces we just talked about, you have to rely on yourself. You can't point your finger at USA Swimming or your club or someone and say, hey, you're the reason that I'm 250 pounds overweight and I'm tired and I hate myself. You have to, you know, you have to be reliant upon yourself. And then self-acceptance. You have to accept wherever you are in your coaching career and have to say, well, this is where I am. And these are my thresholds, and what do I do from here to build myself back up to the top of the pyramid and have more self-confidence? Because an unconfident coach creates unconfident athletes, and that's not what we want. And an unconfident coach is an unhappy coach who won't stay in the sport.
Right. Well, this wouldn't be a podcast if we didn't try and solve a problem in like 5 minutes. So in your research, and I, you know, and you've had opportunity to talk about this professionally now, is there, you know, if a coach realizes there's an issue, maybe not, I mean, maybe everything comes together and he realizes that he's struggling and he works for a board. Is there something that he and his board can do together to help reduce stress on the coach that keeps him coaching at a high level and without him having to disappear from the sport?
Sure. I mean, I think that there definitely are, but not to paint another grim picture, but most lessons are learned the hard way. And I mean, I think you and I have had this discussion before in younger and other situations that I've had. Most lessons are learned at rock bottom. That's just the way the world is. Most of these lessons are learned the hard way, even though we nod our head and we hear, oh, these are the five ways that you know, you can release stress and do this other stuff. A lot of times you end up getting into a place where you know, you're going to have to learn the hard way. But I would say if there's any advice that I have, it's just really good, clear communication as to what you want your coaching career to be like when you're with the club, and have the club and the people on the board be very clear as to about what their expectations are of you. So to be, you know, it's communication. Communication is really, really important. And you have to start having a discussion. I mean, I had discussions in contracts, and I talk with coaches all the time about, redoing their coaching contracts and blah, blah, blah. And how do I get what I'm looking for? And what I'm asking coaches to do now is actually start to negotiate paid sabbaticals and longer vacations and things like that, rather than trying to negotiate for compensation. Because I think it's one of the ways in our sport that coaches can get themselves where they need to be because of the competitive season being 365. You know, I think communicating with your board and being like, hey, I need to, one thing coaches need is time. We just need time to reset. And I think that, you know, communicating with your board and not feeling pinned in by, oh, I need more money or I need this. I think that creating time and space, one of the things I learned from reading the book, it's written by McCowan. It's called, basically the whole book is about the power of no and creating space in your life. I'll remember the title of the book in a minute, but the whole idea is knowing how to unclutter your life to become more productive rather than cluttering your life more, which ruins it. So that's when I came up with the idea of sabbaticals and taking time off and rejuvenating yourself. I think that's one of the greatest things a coach can do is talk to their board about, hey, man, like, if you want me to be as great a coach when I'm 50 as I am when I'm 20, I can't work 70 hours a week anymore. When do I get permission to move from the 25-year-old, know-it-all, run-up-and-down-the-pool-deck guy to the 50-year-old, more sage, advice-giving leader?
Right. To kind of, I can't say close the topic off, but to just put a cap on it for now. Mm-hmm. Whenever you talk to the national team, and whenever you and I have had conversations, you have references, some tools that are available, or some institutions that are available for helping coaches to manage their careers. Mm-hmm. Can you highlight a couple of those so anybody listening could go and check that out?
Oh, geez, you're putting me on the spot there. You know, off the top of my head, I wish that I could remember some of the names of the organizations that we were originally working with. I'm one of those people that when it gets out of my my privy that I kind of forget. If I can remember them, I'll definitely send them over to you if there's a companion to the
podcast. Yeah, do that. We'll put them into either another podcast or an addendum to this one, or maybe even the show notes so people can click and go right to them.
The show notes, maybe we should be able to get some of them on there. But there are some we're beginning to have some high-level research done at the university level about, places where coaches – a lot of the research that I originally had done actually came from teaching unions, because teachers – and actually doctors are also – experiencing similar levels of burnout in today's society. So there is research done. There are resources that are starting to crop up. And when I can find that literature, I have some of the studies and some of the things that people are doing right now. I should be able to get them in the show notes when we're done with this. Hopefully I can get that and we can reference them and people can read them. If not, just so that people can read some of the studies that have been done in Europe on coaching burnout and some of the other stuff, just so they can get some better ideas. Maybe they're feeling the same way and they can understand some of the literature better.
Okay. All right. We'll do that. Let's see. Let's talk before we do the heavy stuff again. Let's talk a little bit more. So one of the interesting things is that you and I have obviously known each other for a long time. And one of the fun things for me coaching with you is that you were always, I don't want to say encouraging, but never discouraging to trying things, you know, if I'd come in and be like, hey, I ordered a heart rate monitor from Australia, you know, we're going to give this thing a try. And, but I really felt like 25, 30 years ago, you really had to search out for some non-traditional tools to help you with your coaching. Well, fast forward to today where there's everything. You know, you want to know how well your athletes are sleeping at night. There's a monitor and an app for that. If you don't just like swimming with a bucket and you would rather have, you know, five different size chutes or, you know, different size hand paddles, it seems as if the equipment industry surrounding swimming and the recovery portion of it has exploded. So taking all of that into consideration, are there anything that you still consider to be must-haves if you are a coach trying to teach your athletes, or if you're an athlete looking for a tool that you might not have?
Well, I mean, this is a subject for me that's pretty close to the heart. I mean, maybe I'll sound a little bit like Vern. You know,
it's okay.
In my opinion, the most important tool you can have is a good eye. I know that sounds silly, but the coach's eye is still the most important tool by far. The human eye and the brain and the connections between them are more complex than any training tool, any evaluation software, and smarter than any PhD in the entire planet. The coaching eye is just so important that I can't overstate it. It's not something you can teach. It's not something that I necessarily have, that I claim to have, but you have to use your eye. And you have to ask a lot of really good questions. Having said that, I think a couple things. One, the reason that we're seeing an advent of that, in my opinion, is that marketing and the consumer culture has made its way into sports. It's become a way now we know that the most competitive sport in the world is parenting. And now that we have dollars behind that, we have a lot of dollars behind it. Now you're seeing they're filling the void, supply and demand. The demand for new ways to train, the demand is there. Technology is now there to back it up. So, you know, we have all kinds of new technologies that people are trying out. We have everything from what's that Omega Wave, you know, the technology that they're doing athlete monitoring with, at places like Man U and all over the world, the highest levels, all the way down to still we're doing heart rate monitors and that type of stuff.
The Omega Wave, that's the brainwave one?
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, there's, you know, athlete monitoring is huge business now. GPS, global positioning stuff, you know, measuring all the biometrics. That's because we now, once again, we have sports scientists and we have ways to measure things. So now we're measuring them and we don't even know what we're measuring. Some things we're measuring, we don't even know if they have any, we don't know if they have any significance at all, but we can measure them. So if you can measure it, you can market it. And I think that's one of the things we need to watch out as coaches. If this is not just a public service announcement, maybe it is. But I think we have to watch out. We have to really watch out for tools and tricks. Instead of finding the tricks of the trade and the little tools that help us, we're better off telling coaches it's time to learn the trade. You know, it's not the 1%, it's the 99%. We have to learn a little bit better. And we can get paralysis by analysis because we measure too many things and we start to put too many numbers in front of us. We're not using our eye, we're not using what we know to move the sports forward. So I guess having said that, I mean, you know, the best tools that I used, I mean, because I am not averse to using tools. Like I said, I've tried everything and gone down the rabbit hole of lots of different tools. We used, you know, I'm obviously a big fan of Jan Olbrecht and the Science of Winning. I mean, you and I think we were pretty big and having that actually be a big part of the sport here in the United States. I did lactate testing for a long time on a team level, on a professional level. And I found that frankly, it was not all it was cracked out to be. And I didn't need to know how many millimoles someone's blood had or the recovery rate, even though it was popularized by even USA Swimming Science and some other things. I didn't need those tools to know what my eye already told me.
Right.
For the most part, 99% of the time, I didn't need some of those tools, and that tool just faded away. I guess what I would say is we need to make sure technology becomes an aid to training and not a centerpiece, and that can be a definite That could be a definite problem for some programs who I know are really, really into heart rate or whatever it is. And I know you and I had this discussion 20 years ago. Even Jan Olbrecht has said, look, this is just one piece of a multi-sided die. And you're just looking at one side of this die. So anytime you use a piece of technology, what you're doing is trying to use a piece of science to interpret what your eye is already seeing. So, I mean, I don't know. I like the Tempo Trainer. I mean, that's one of my tools that I think I could never move away from. I think it's just kind of a fun thing, you know?
Yeah. No, I was going to say, if there was anything in the last few years that has been introduced as a tool that you've said, man, I have been waiting for this.
I say the one thing that I started using when I went down to T2 that Tom Yetter, who's a fantastic age group coach, and just fantastic coach, period, introduced me to was this thing called a HAL, or basically it's a clock. It's a programmable clock, mm-hmm. basically. And I'm sure that, you know, people who've used Workout Manager and stuff, you know, kind of laugh at this, but this swim nerd clock they have now where you can program in the sets and it beeps and it sends them on their way. It's a tool that I really, really encourage people to use if they're not doing, you know, deep dive technique work on no clock. Which I think is a good tool. But using a clock that's programmable for the sets allows the set to do the conditioning and allows the kids to know their times, and the coach isn't standing there staring at their watch. I'm able to coach. So this tool tells the kids when to go, when the set's over, when the next set is. I can program the whole thing in, and then I can coach my butt off while I'm coaching. So the programmable clock has been something that in recent years I've found to be awesome.
Okay, that's great. All right. A couple minutes ago, you were talking about the most competitive sport out there has been the sport of parenting. Yep. And anybody that has listened to the podcast before or spoken to me privately, one of my biggest possibilities to go on a rant is when mm-hmm. somebody uses the kids these days line.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. I think largely that our kids are primarily a product of the environment that we, the adults, have placed them in, and their parents. So mm-hmm. to then turn around and start blaming the kids for their behavior always seems mm-hmm. a little silly. Mm-hmm. But I'm always willing to be convinced otherwise. Are the kids these days a problem? Do they need to be taught differently? Do we need to throw out what we know and approach them in a different manner?
I mean, I think those are always good questions, and you know, I think as someone considers myself a child educator and a teacher, and I think that was probably when I started thinking about this, these concepts more. Maybe it's because I was older, or maybe I just, as I was looking for deeper meaning in what I was doing as a coach, I decided that, you know, coaches are teachers, mm-hmm. And, you know, being sure. able to teach is important. And I mean, your wife's a teacher, and I've always had a desire to have a background in, you know, pedagogy and teaching how to teach and that type of stuff. Kids will always just be the product of their environment, period. Now, having said that, parents are not the only thing that's a major impact on what they're doing. Kids, their peer group, and now we have, because we're so device-driven, I'm just going to use the blanket term, social media. I'm just going to use the term the internet. Mm-hmm. I'm going to lump all that stuff into internet and technology. Parents, peer groups, and technology are always going to be the three biggest things. When your child is young, the parent is the strongest, is going to be the strongest influence in a child's life. And it's the most important. Up until the age of four, you know, the psychology is pretty strong. I mean, up until the age of four or five, the parent is going to be the major driver in whether or not what a lot of those child's behaviors are going to be. And things like agreeability, willingness to play, willingness to share, those types of things, likability, a lot of those things are shaped in those early 3 to 5 year olds. And my mother teaches 3 to 5 year olds. I've read research on a lot of those formidable years. And if you're a kid and you don't play well with other kids, by the time you're 4 or 5 years old, that starts to shape your peer groups. It starts to shape who will play with you. It starts to shape with how you'll interact in groups. a lot of those things start to move from there. So the parents are still massively, massively responsible for all of that. Kids can't be any different than the parent than the adults and the society make them. And since adults make up society, that's them. And that's when we get back down to boiling down to individual responsibility. The more we can boil it down to responsibility, because the other thing that we hear, Dan, that I roll my eyes at maybe even more is, you know, parents are like, wow, you know, kids these days. And the other people say, well, it's just society. Well, who's society? It's you. Hmm. You know, it's you as the adult. So I think that those things all boil back down more to great parenting, deciding what peer groups your children are going to interact in. That shapes them the most. Once we know we get to the formidable years, peer groups are three times. Don't quote me on this. Once again, this is not my area of expertise, but I have read some of the literature. I think it's up to three times more impressionable by their peer. You know, from they get more impressions from their peers than they do from their parents at that standpoint. So making sure that the child's peer groups are good is tremendously important. Hence, choose swimming. You know, you're going to start with some pretty good kids there. But there is a technology component to this that we've never been able to deal with before. I don't know that we have a really good way of dealing with it. Frankly, from listening to experts in the field talk on this, technology is advancing at such a rate that even by the time we have a way to deal with and cope with from a psychological standpoint or from a sociological standpoint with things like Snapchat and Facebook, as soon as we figure out how to deal with that, they're going to be on. We're on to the next thing already.
Certainly.
The kids will be on to what's next. So we do have an unknown area that the fact that this technology is advancing quicker than we can deal with. And the fact is that the kids understand the technology better than we ever will is also another scary thing. Tim Elmore, and I know there's a lot of people who have done a lot of generational studies and things like this. I think that they have some pretty decent, maybe broad brushstroke ideas on how to deal with different generational things. I really find I find that accusing generations, whether they be millennials, whether they be whatever, I find that accusing them of being a certain way is disgusting. Because they can only be what the product of society or are the three things that we outlined, their peer groups, their parents, and technology. They can only be what we allow them to be. And I know that litigation, I mean, obviously the litigious nature of the society that we live in is maybe another factor in that. And the fast moving, you know, drive through, I want it my way, I want it now, culture that we've created for ourselves, perpetuates some of these things. But it still comes down to parents, man. Kids are not kids these days. I don't have children. I'd be blessed one day to have them. But as someone who works with children on a daily basis, I don't need to know, you know, I don't need to know how to build a car to drive one. So I don't know that I need to be a parent to have an opinion on it. And I think that parents are failing at their responsibilities.
Hmm. Another quote from Chris Webb. Put that on the website.
Put it on the website. That's right. But plenty of parents aren't failing. Plenty of parents are doing a fantastic job. So.
It's interesting because like my kids, they're 11 and 8 years old, mm-hmm. and they have whatever the average amount of technology and screen time, to use, mm-hmm. you know, a standard term, mm-hmm. as anybody else's kid. Not more, probably not less, you know, probably sure. the average amount. But the most mm-hmm. effective coaches they've had have been the most fun and the most interesting, and sure. not the ones that, you know, hooked up something to their brain while they were training or, sure. you know, the fault I always had was of overusing video, you know, to show uh-huh, how to correct. Do stuff and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. They're just super engaged and were able to deal with the kid naturally and mm-hmm. make them interested in whatever sport they happened to be taking part of in that time or activity. You know, there were some, you know, phenomenal like other extracurricular activities. So I don't know if constantly trying to rebrand the coaches as being the most receptive to this new generation of kids is actually useful, because they're still searching for somebody that's going to make them love and enjoy the sport or activity that you've introduced them to. Mm-hmm. That's all they want. They want to have a good time. They want to have fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm hearing everything you're saying, and you probably say a lot of things that I'm saying more succinctly with less words. Economy of words is pretty important. Dr. Tanabria would have said that at Pitt when I was a student there. Chris, economy of words. Okay. I have a few comments on that. One is that we're not clowns, man. You know, it's like that's kind of what I think a lot of what we have societally, to use that loose term, which I said never use just a couple minutes ago, that we're here to entertain people. We have an entertainment culture. I think the device, having stimulation from a device is really an issue. I've found that using the device is great when you can use it, because kids are used to looking at things through the lens of their device. And when I mean device, I just iPhone or whatever it is. Sure. So I've used that pretty successfully on the pool deck when I think I need to use it. I use it sparingly, but we use it extremely effectively to do what I would call peer coaching and using lessons. And they understand looking at things through a lens. I listened to a battlefield, not to get off topic, but I listened to a battlefield journalist talk about standing in Fallujah and standing in the middle of a gunfight with some special forces. And the cameraman stood there while everyone was laying down taking fire. And it was the cameraman was a young man, maybe in his early 20s. And they described it after the battle. He said, well, it was kind of like I was just watching the fight on YouTube.
Hmm.
But he was in the tube. His reality was through the lens of that. So I just use that as an example of, I think that same reality is a reality that a lot of our young kids have. They understand things, and they're going to start understanding things almost exclusively through the lens of a device. And I think that we can't take that for granted, but we're in trouble. Like you said, we're in trouble if we use technology as a centerpiece. I think schools that use technology as a centerpiece are making huge mistakes. I think that teams who use too much video and do that stuff are making huge mistakes, because we have millions of years of evolution that tell us that that's not how the human brain works. That's not how we work. That's why I think the coaches that you're describing make better connections, because those are true primal human connections. And that's what I would say also, is the lessons that need to be learned don't change. The lessons don't change. Maybe the style in which we need to teach the lessons or the tools we use to teach the lessons might change, but we should be very wary of doing it overly through technology, since that hasn't been a part of the human. I mean, it's been a part of us for less than 100 years.
Yeah.
But we don't know what the long-term ramifications are. We already have good research that says that, you know, reading blogs and short form stuff has hurt our ability to create neural pathways for long form thinking, you know? My last piece to this is it's political, so I'm not really going to get into it, but I think the style in which, and the things that kids are taught in school nowadays, it's definitely changed over the last 35 years. So I think that there are ways that kids are taught to interact with teachers, that have changed, the rules of engagement, so to speak, in the pedagogy. So I think that we have to learn better ways to capture the attention of the kids.
Amen. All right. I just out of respect to you and maybe some of our listeners here, I'm gonna cut us off here. but I can't thank you enough for
giving
me all this time. But before I let you go, do you you got some websites, some social media? Anything, if people were interested in your services or Vern or any of those things, anything you want to plug or push along here?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you want to take a look at Vern's blog, which I think is really excellent, it's the Functional Path, thefunctionalpath.com. You can find that. You can easily Google search that and find it. I'm working right now on a clinic that we're hosting in La Jolla in conjunction with Team Elite and David Marsh there. We're hosting a strength and conditioning clinic May 10th and the 12th for swimming professionals, strength coaches in colleges, swim coaches, age group people. It'll be pretty fantastic. Our faculty is unreal. Chris Plum, Ian Murray, Tom Barton from Queensland Institute of Sport, the guy who started the Q-Swim app. And you can find us at the GAIN Network /swimming.
Okay.
On the old World Wide Web, and you can find out about our clinics and some of the other stuff that we offer. We also offer a clinic in the fall over the ASCO weekend in Carmel, Indiana.
All right. Are you writing yet? Do you have anything online for people to read?
I currently have not done any writing for myself online anywhere. I stopped writing that probably in 2012. I probably should get back to it. But you could send me an email at webswim@hotmail.com. I know I do speaking engagements and consulting with teams. I speak at HODs. I speak for at LSCs and do the, all that type of stuff. So if anybody's interested.
Awesome. All right. Thanks again, Chris.
You got it.
Okay. Thank you for listening to Kick Set. I hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I enjoyed sitting down with Chris. Make sure that you subscribe to the Kick Set podcast. And while you're there, take a peek at some of the past episodes and make sure that you haven't missed one. And given the opportunity to review, we would certainly appreciate a 5-star review. And be sure to tell your friends and family about us too. Post links to the podcast on your social media feeds and get it out there. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Kick Set with USA Swimming. Check out www.usaswimming.org/kickset for more episodes and add Kick Set to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes.